The gospel lesson this morning comes from Matthew chapter 25, verses 14 through 30. It can be found in your pew Bible on page 1541. And it's the parable of the talents. Again, it will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted his property to them. To one he gave 5 talents of money, to another 2 talents, and to another one, 1 talent, each according to his ability. Then he went on his journey. The man who had received 5 talents went at once and put the money to work and gained 5 more. So also the one with 2 talents gained 2 more. But the man who had received the 1 talent went off, dug a hole in the ground, and hid his master's money. After a long time, the master of those servants returned and settled accounts with them. The man who had received the 5 talents brought the other 5. Master, he said, you entrusted me with 5 talents. See, I have gained 5 more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. The man with the 2 talents also came. Master, he said, you entrusted me with 2 talents. See, I have gained 2 more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. Then the man who had received the one talent came. Master, he said, I knew that you are a hard man, harvesting where you have not sown and gathering where you have not scattered seed. So I was afraid and went out and hid your talent in the ground. See, here is what belongs to you. His master replied, you wicked, lazy servant. So you knew that I harvest where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed. Well then, you should have put my money on deposit with bankers so that when I returned, I would have received it back with interest. Take the 1 talent from him and give it to the one who has 10 talents. For everyone who has will be given more, and he will have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what he has, will be taken from him. And throw that worthless servant outside into the darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. The word of the Lord for people of God. Thanks be to God. Please make yourselves comfortable. May these words of my mouth, the meditations of my heart, be pleasing in your sight, Lord, my rock and my redeemer. Amen. Good morning. As I said in the welcome, I'm honored to have been asked by Reverend Paul to lead and preach in worship service this morning. Again, my name is Jeff, and I'm a layperson like all of you and a member of the Mount Zion United Methodist Church congregation. I'm an active duty naval officer, but I'm working towards becoming a certified lay speaker in the United Methodist Church while trying to discern God's will for my post-military career. Reverend Paul is doing a sermon series on superheroes. Last week, she covered The Greatest American Hero and Ralph's search for a super suits instruction manual. Like Ralph, we have an instruction manual for our lives, the Bible. Unlike Ralph, we don't have to find it, we have it. We just have to read it. The superhero I'm discussing this morning is one I'm sure everyone here is familiar with. It's the story of a young man in New York City who, though despite challenging, humble beginnings, becomes a beacon of hope to a city in times of strife. His name is Peter Parker, but some of you may know him by his alter ego, Spider-Man. Now, for sake of transparency, because there's a number of movies and comics and everything else, I used the 2002 movie titled Spider-Man with Tobey Maguire as the basis for my discussion on his story, just to prevent any arguments later if there's any comic book buffs in the audience. Challenging and humble beginnings. You know, if you've seen the movie, you see the opening scene, and there's this young man chasing a school bus, trying to get to stop, slapping the sides, and everyone's laughing at him, the bus driver included, who left him at a stop. He may have been late, we don't know, doesn't matter. But if the adults in his life find it humorous to laugh at such things while leaving him behind. I mean, you can only imagine what the rest of his life is like and what it's been. For reasons unknown to us, he's raised by his Aunt May and Uncle Ben. And he's madly in love with his next-door neighbor, Mary Jane, or MJ. But she doesn't even realize that he has those affections for her. Probably, you know, in a lot of ways, barely realizes he's there. In all the ways that matter to the average teenager, he's not doing so well. He's not a star athlete. He's not good with the girls. He only has one real friend who's presented, quite frankly, as an opposite to him. His friend is wealthy, smooth talker, and above most of the high school petty high school issues that Peter struggles with on a day-to-day basis. Now, it wouldn't be much a movie or a story if things didn't change. Things change. He's bitten by a unique spider that's genetically engineered to have some amazing traits. Now, surprising to me, I have arachnophobia, right? If I was bit by a spider, I'd be really upset, and I'd probably go to the hospital. He does not end up poisoned on his deathbed in the hospital, but instead starts a transformation that he doesn't quite understand. You know, and as you think about that, the challenges we all faced and we will face during our teenage years aren't hard enough. I mean, you have the hormones raging, you're testing the dating waters, you're learning and transitioning into adulthood. Now Peter suddenly finds himself having super strength, spider-like climbing ability, a sixth danger sense he calls Spidey Sense, and he shoots spider webs from his wrists. As you'd expect, this transition causes some problems in Peter's life. He ends up getting a fight and beating up the football player who bullies him, and he blows off some important family obligations to his uncle. To top it all off, his love interest, MJ, her boyfriend gets an awesome car as a graduation present, and she's excited, and she leaves talking to him and really embarrasses him. Now, as a teenage guy, he obviously feels the need to impress her. So he comes up with an idea. He decides to wrestle in an amateur wrestling match where if he makes it 3 minutes, he makes $3,000. Pretty good return on investment. So as you can guess, his aunt and uncle see these changes. I mean, he got in a fight in school, and he's behaving differently, blowing off things he'd never blown off before. And so Ben pulls him aside and says, "Hey, I'll drive you to the city." And he uses the opportunity to talk to him, confronts him. And he gives him a really well-thought-out speech, and I'm going to read some of it to you here today, right now. "These are the years when a man changes into the man he will be for the rest of his life." And he goes on to talk about how, you know, hey, that guy you beat up probably deserved it. He's doing bad things, you know. But just because you can doesn't mean you should. And he finishes the talk with, "With great power comes great responsibility." Now, Peter was obviously frustrated by this. He doesn't see the problems. He's in the thick of it. He doesn't understand. He gets defensive. And he says what's probably one of the absolute most hurtful things that a son can say to a man who's raising him as his father, but is not his father, an adoptive father figure. He says, "You're not my father. Stop acting like it." And storms out of the car. Regardless of the hurt that Ben's feeling, he says, shouts after him, says, "Stop, hey, look, I'll pick you up at 10, right? I'm still going to take you home. I'm not going to make you take the bus or whatever other route he'd have to take." So Peter goes to the wrestling match, and all the odds seem stacked against him. The whole crowd is opposed. The guy he has to wrestle is this gargantuan of a human being who just wants to rip his head from his shoulders and crush him. And he gets put in a cage with him, and they lock the door. And against all the odds, as observed by the crowd, because we know he's Spider-Man and he has some pretty powerful abilities, he wins. And the promoter stiffs him. He gives him $100. So as he's waiting to leave and he's bummed out because he only has $100 instead of the $3,000 he thought he was going to get, a man robs the promoter and Peter steps aside and just lets him go. And he runs off and escapes. The next scene, we see Peter walking to meet his uncle at the car. Instead of his uncle waiting there in his car, it is a crime scene. And his uncle ends up dying in his arms without being able to really have a conversation. So the last words that Peter had to his uncle were the hurtful, you know, words he shared with him. As he's grieving, Peter overhears where the suspect is, and leaves the scene, presumably to get revenge on the killer. He tracks him down, and the fight through the car chase scene ends up driving the man into an abandoned building, where during the confrontation, Peter realizes that the man he chased down who killed his uncle is the man who robbed the promoter, and he let go. And he is crushed with guilt. Now, it takes a while. It takes several months. Peter spends some time in mourning for his uncle, and he's burdened by his guilt that from his actions that led to his uncle's death. But he ultimately reflects on the advice that Ben provided him during the argument in the car. With great power comes great responsibility. And Peter uses those words as a means to address his guilt through actions. And he becomes Spider-Man, and the rest is comic book and cinematic history. Now, how does Peter's transformation from a geeky, unpopular teenager into Spider-Man help us understand a lesson from our life's instruction manual, the Bible? As we consider this question, consider the answer to this question, we realize that God has invested in us, and that investment, he expects a return on that. I mean, when I invest in my retirement accounts, I expect a return on that someday so that I can live after I'm not working anymore and provide for myself and my family. Need to. I think everyone here can understand the truth that Jesus Christ is God. He was born as a man, fulfilled the old covenant for the Israelites, provided us with the gospel through his time ministering, was crucified, and he was resurrected from the dead to defeat sin. There's a lot to unpack there, and people have spent a lifetime studying it. I think we can all acknowledge that that's what happened. That's what we believe. That's why we're here. And he did this because God, he decided to invest in us through his actions. He wants a relationship with us, and we were unable to fulfill the original covenant he provided us. Our eternal salvation has been assured through the grace that we are given, grace we cannot earn and most likely do not deserve. This is foundational to our faith. Now, once we're saved and we start to believe and we follow, we are provided gifts by the Holy Spirit. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. And that's from Galatians chapter 5, verse 22. The world around us, the people we interact with at work, while commuting, shopping, and living our daily lives, are bound by the desires of the flesh. We should be above the works of the flesh. Idolatry, strife, jealousy, fits of anger, rivalries and divisions, to name some of them. And that's also from Galatians chapter 5. These gifts are power in and of themselves. So I work at the Pentagon and I drive on the Beltway sometimes, from time to time. Anyone who's ever driven on the Beltway? Right? It's probably pretty easy to feel anger and fits of anger or rivalries when, you know, the same guy keeps cutting in front of you to get that, you know, get to work 5 seconds faster, or the guys that like to pull off into the shoulder and drive past the entire line of cars waiting to get ahead, right? We're not called to respond that way. And we're given the tools to respond appropriately. I know that's one of the struggles I have personally is driving. I enjoy driving. It's fun. But I don't enjoy over-to-over traffic around the Beltway and the behavior of people around me. Our lives themselves are a gift from God. God did not have to create humanity, the world as we know it, or our individual lives, who we are. He didn't have to provide us with free will, skills, abilities, knowledge, or reason. Now, all people have these things. They're not unique to Christians. But they are still God-given blessings. All of the things in the world we have to use for our purposes are gifts from God. We don't own the world. We're merely stewards of it until Jesus returns. As Americans, consider our political system and how it's different than much of the world, and how much power that gives us to love our neighbor through how we govern ourselves. Consider the biblical lessons read earlier this morning. In Jeremiah, he's telling us about instructions given to the Israelites during their exile to Babylon. The exiles are basically told to live regular lives. in their place of exile. Build houses, live in them, plant gardens, and eat the produce. Get married and have your kids marry. But verse 7 adds more to the instruction. Don't just do those day-to-day things. Don't just do the mundane and live your lives. But seek the welfare of the city. Pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will find your welfare. The exiles are told to care about the well-being of the city that they are stuck in after being kicked out of Jerusalem. Not just do things to improve the welfare of the city, but pray to the Lord on its behalf. If those are the instructions to the exiled Israelites, none of us here have been exiled from our homes, have been exiled from St. Mary's County, Maryland, or the United States, and live in other countries because our homes aren't safe. If that's God's expectation of the Israelites as they're exiled, I imagine that God's expectation for us who are in our homeland is at least the same, if not more. There are many ways to interpret the New Testament lesson, the parable of the talents. In ancient Israel, a talent was a monetary unit worth about 20 years' wage for a laborer. Jesus tells us a man is going on a journey, and he gives three of his servants different amounts of money based on their abilities. One servant's given 5 talents, one servant's given 2, and the last is given 1. The first 2 double it. They do things. They trade, they invest, and they make double the amount of money back. The third guy, he's afraid. He says, "Hey, look, boss, I know you're a shrewd negotiator, you're a good businessman, and you terrify me, so I'm going to, instead of doing something useful with this, I'm going to bury it in the dirt, and when you came back, I give it back to you. Here you are, boss." And how'd that go for him? Right? What was the master's reaction to that? It wasn't good. The master is pleased with the 2 servants who doubled the money, but he was furious with the servant who hid his money in the ground and kept it safe. The master said to take the 1 talent from the last servant and give it to the first who made 5 extra talents. In verse 29, it says, "For everyone who has been given, who has will be given, and he will have an abundance. But the one who has not, even what little he has will be taken away." So in researching for the sermon this morning, did you know that the word talent in English is actually derived because of this parable? In Old English, it actually developed into the English language because of the skills and the underlying message here. So I interpret the parable that God has invested in us, and he expects a return. We're not all created identically. We all have different talents. Some of us are naturally strong, athletic, and skilled with hand-eye coordination. Others are brilliant orators, thinkers, or writers. People are born into different economic situations. Some families are wealthy beyond belief, while others are not able to provide enough food for their family every day. And most of us are somewhere in between that. Regardless of what our natural skills are or the situation we're born into, we are expected to produce a return on God's investment based on what we're given. Now, what do I mean by a return on his investment? So I go to this passage. "And a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself." And that's from Matthew chapter 22, verse 39. Our neighbors need us in many ways. First, the world needs to know about Jesus. They need to see and hear the good news. How can the lost people of the world gain the faith in Jesus that saves them if they never experience the gospel in their day-to-day lives? No matter how many talents we have, we can all provide witness to the world through our daily lives. We can use the fruits of the Spirit, those gifts the Holy Spirit gives us, because we believe. We can remain patient and kind when the human emotional reaction should be anger. The people around us will notice. We're different. There's something special going on. People will ask. People will observe. I truly hope that you're open about it, willing to share how God has impacted your life. living the witness while you speak it. Not everyone is called to come up to the pulpit and to talk from up here. Not everyone's expected to do that. I don't know if I'm expected to do that. I'm trying. But everyone's expected to live the gospel and share that love with those around them and tell about the good news. I would guess that everyone here has heard of Billy Graham. I'd correlate his life's work, to being the man given 5 talents and returning with 10. If you don't have 5 talents, you're not expected to give back 10. Don't be daunted by the task at hand. It's not our plan. It's not our will. God is always with us. Do what you can. Second, the world needs us to meet the physical needs of those around us. There's hunger in this world. I mean both inside and outside of our country. Focusing on the country, we have 1 in 6 people in the United States face food insecurity. And according to Merriam-Webster, that's unable to consistently access or afford adequate food. All countries, all counties within the country are affected by this, with approximately 17.5 million households in the U.S. Additionally, 1 in 7 people in the country qualify for SNAP, otherwise known as food stamps. And about half of those people are children. This is but one area that people need help in. It's easy to look at. The statistics exist. There are others. Homelessness. There's about 500,000 people in our own country every night that don't have a roof over their head. And in the world, there's a major issue with displaced persons. If you look at Syria and Yemen, there's a mass civilian population displaced due to violence and war that they have no power to control. These are just 2 other areas. There's plenty of others. We're not going to go into all that today. I mention all of this not to bring you down on a Sunday morning, but to demonstrate the need in our country and around the world. The world itself is a cruel place. We are called to be God's light in the world. You don't have to be a millionaire to help those around you. The church here has several programs collecting to support local people in need. And I was pleased to watch as people came in and gave to those efforts. They're up there on the pew right there. There are several local programs run through the government, including food banks, Project Warm to assist with homelessness, and Christmas in April. And there's plenty more. Not everyone here has the same talents, can invest the same amount of resources to help out, but do what you can. All of us here in the United States are afforded a power in our political process. Be aware of the issues facing us in our country, who the candidates are, what they're about. Pray about these decisions and participate in the political process with an ethic based on your faith. If your gifts and talents allow for you to run for public office and you feel called to do so, run and use God's investment in you for the greater good. All these things being present, I think one of my favorite phrases is appropriate here. Many hands make light work. The world will change around us if we, all of us, love our neighbors and live the gospel. Revisiting the story from Spider-Man, Peter is given something like 10 or 20 talents. Right, he's superhuman. He has some extraordinary abilities that, I mean, it's fictional, right? And how does he initially use his powers? He beats up his bully, and he tries to earn enough money to buy a car in order to impress a girl. That changes. I mean, he learns from that. But that's initially a very self-centered use of the wonderful talents he's provided. How many talents have you been given? If you had to settle accounts with God tomorrow, would you be giving a return on his investment or holding steady? In closing, consider the lyrics of the popular song Do Something by Matthew West. Well, I couldn't just bear the thought of people living in poverty, children sold into slavery. The thought disgusted me. So I shook my fist at heaven and said, God, why don't you do something? And he said, this is God, I did, yeah, I created you. We all have great power. Do something.